and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. President Trump declared he's just getting started during his long speech to a joint session of Congress last night, considering the sweeping changes to US domestic and foreign policy over the past 43 days. Many may wonder if the momentum can be maintained. But Mr. Trump was full of energy as he spoke for around 1 hour, 40 minutes. His audience was also lively, Republicans cheering and whooping his pronouncements, some Democrats, though, heckling and booing. One was even kicked out of the chamber for showing a lack of decorum. Well, Mr. Trump congratulated Elon Musk for his sweeping cost-cutting efforts, and Republicans gave Mr. Musk a standing ovation. The president also defended his tariff policies. With all the highlights, here's our Washington correspondent, Nomia Iqbal.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
President Trump walked into the chamber, shaking hands with excited Republicans. This was his moment to boast.
America is back. We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or 8 years. And we are just getting started.
He praised all the domestic actions he has taken so far, such as on immigration.
I deployed the U.S. military and Border Patrol to repel the invasion of our country.
And spending cuts.
We are draining the swamp. It's very simple. And the days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over.
He praised his close ally, the unelected tech billionaire Elon Musk, who arrived with the president for the address.
Thank you, Elon. He's working very hard. He didn't need this. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Everybody here.
He's appointed the world's richest man to reduce government spending and boost the U.S.'s space ambitions.
We're going to lead humanity into space and plant the American flag on the planet Mars and even far beyond.
In a key moment, Donald Trump reached out to Ukraine's President Zelensky after days of criticizing him.
It's time to stop this madness. It's time to halt the killing. It's time to end this senseless war. If you want to end wars, you have to talk to both sides.
It's after Mr. Zelensky made a statement saying he wanted to move forward.
We've had serious discussions with Russia and have received strong signals that they are ready for peace. Wouldn't that be beautiful?
Mr. Trump also repeated his trade war threat.
If you don't make your product in America, however, under the Trump administration, you will pay a tariff, and in some cases, a rather large one.
President Trump looks and sounds like he did the first time round, but now he's more experienced and emboldened. His speech really underlines the blitz of action he's taken since he returned to the White House. He's testing the boundaries of power and creating confusion, with Democrats, the opposition, unsure how to react. One congressman stood up and heckled Mr. Trump. Al Green of Texas was eventually kicked out by the Speaker, Mike Johnson.
Members are engaging in willful and continuing breach of decorum, and the chair is prepared to direct the Sergeant-at-Arms to restore order to the joint session.
Other Democrats brought signs reading false, pay your taxes, and this isn't normal. Some said nothing as Mr. Trump taunted them. President Trump arrived here at the Capitol as polls suggest Americans are split on the start of his second term. He can't run again, giving him 4 years to deliver on his big, bold promises.
The golden age of America has only just begun. It will be like nothing that has ever been seen before. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Our Washington correspondent Nomia Iqbal with that report. Well, Susan Page was also watching the speech last night and the reaction it got with lawmakers. She's the Washington bureau chief for USA Today and she joins us live. Susan, welcome to the programme. So there were no great surprises, in fact, in this speech, which some had been braced for. Which bits did you think were the most significant?
Well, I thought we heard a campaign address. There was no difference between this speech and one he might have given in the heat of the campaign, down to the point of criticizing at one point Kamala Harris, the Democratic candidate he defeated, and repeatedly castigating Joe Biden, who, by the way, is no longer president. So it was different from the traditional presidential speech to Congress, which typically is conciliatory and lays out a legislative agenda for the year. This was more a doubling down on his general approach to this office and to this second term.
You mentioned the Democrats there. The rebuttal for them was delivered by a relative newcomer, Alyssa Slotkin. She's a Senate Democrat for Michigan. I think she's a former analyst for the CIA as well, and something of a rising star, it seems, for the opposition. Let's just hear a little bit of what she had to say.
President Trump loves to say peace through strength. That's actually a line he stole from Ronald Reagan. But let me tell you, after the spectacle that just took place in the Oval Office last week, Reagan must be rolling in his grave. We all want an end to the war in Ukraine, but Reagan understood that true strength required America to combine our military and economic might with moral clarity. And that scene in the Oval Office wasn't just a bad episode of reality TV. It summed up Trump's whole approach to the world. He believes in cozying up to dictators like Vladimir Putin and kicking our friends like the Canadians in the teeth. He sees American leadership as merely a series of real estate transactions.
Democrat Senator Alyssa Slotkin there, hoping to stoke up some division within Republicans, it seems. But I just want to mention, Susan, something in Nomia's report there, talking about possible division within the Democratic opposition, unsure of how to react.
Yes. And of course, this is no longer Ronald Reagan's Republican Party. This is Donald Trump's Republican Party. And we saw Democrats last night divided over how to respond because they have no base of power, not the White House, not the House, not the Senate. And they have yet to find a consistent and coherent message to take to Americans. Their biggest strategy now is assuming that Trump will go too far and that there will be a backlash.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the Democrats kind of being in disarray. It was quite interesting that it was Ms. Slotkin chosen to give the rebuttal. There doesn't seem to be a leader rallying support around any in particular, one person in particular at the moment.
No, and with our system, you know, we usually don't have a leader for the party until we have a presidential candidacy. Then that person, the president or the candidate for president, becomes the leader of the party. That's just a feature of our system. And Senator Slotkin is not particularly well known, but here's what she did. She outperformed Donald Trump. She outperformed Kamala Harris in the swing state of Michigan in the last election. And so Democrats are hoping that her kind of moderate message will help them regain some traction. After all, as Trump pointed out last night, Democrats lost all seven swing states in November.
Briefly, Mr. Trump did talk about his mandate. Obviously, that was clear from the election results in November. But is there any sign that some voters may be changing their minds given all the changes since he's come into office?
Well, polling is showing that Americans are a little nervous about the possibility of inflation going up. That was Trump's strongest single issue in the campaign. And there's fear that these tariffs that are being levied are going to push that number up.
Great to speak to you today. Thank you so much for joining us live. That's Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Now, during his address to a joint session of Congress, Donald Trump read aloud a letter he said he'd received from Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, which was similar, really, to the message posted on social media by Mr. Zelensky earlier in the day. Mr. Trump said he appreciated the letter. So could there be a thawing now of relations since that dramatic row we saw in the Oval Office last Friday. Just before we came on air, I spoke to our correspondent in Kiev, James Waterhouse. So this letter does seem to have gone down well. It was worded very carefully. Can Ukrainian diplomatic efforts like this reset the relationship now with the White House?
I think to a degree, you're right. I mean, the wording was everything, and it clearly landed in time for Donald Trump's address to the US Congress, that President Zelensky was willing with his team to work under Donald Trump's strong leadership, that he was ready for a quick and lasting peace. I mean, that would have been music to Donald Trump's ears. But I think it also reflects a running out of political road for Volodymyr Zelensky. You strongly suspect that his European allies, whilst they've sort of wrapped their political arms around him of late, have said, look, you're going to have to say sorry, or words to the effect. See, now, he's not apologised for what we saw in the Oval Office. Many here would argue it wasn't his fault. But I think now, I mean, he even gave specifics as to what that early ceasefire process could bring, with the pausing of drone attacks and even a naval ceasefire in the Black Sea. But there are two glaring questions here. Why has he said he's agreeing to sign a mineral deal with no security guarantees? Mm. And what about Russia? There are no signs of Russian compromise yet in Donald Trump's vision. Mm. And I think that is a gamble of course, seismic proportions.
Or even criticism. In fact, it must be said from the Trump administration so far. You mentioned, James, the European allies, and we've had news in from the Elysee Palace this morning in Paris from President Macron's spokesperson suggesting that there could be another Oval Office meeting, this time perhaps involving Mr. Macron, Prime Minister Starmer of the UK, and President Zelensky with Mr. Trump. How might that go down?
I think this might help in a language sense, maybe. President Zelensky's English has come on a long way, but clearly, given what happened last time in the Oval Office, I think it was a tall order to come under such a shouting assault whilst making your case. So perhaps if you have two fluent English speakers alongside Volodymyr Zelensky, perhaps that might smooth things over. I mean, you're clearly seeing France and the UK playing mediator across the Atlantic to try and keep Donald Trump sweet.
On the position of the White House, we did also hear from Mike Walls earlier on today. He was speaking to Fox News, and he mentioned that military support for Ukraine could be restored if peace talks are arranged. Will that be encouraging for Kiev?
It's as encouraging as it can be, right? We've just had the director of the CIA saying that they've also paused some intelligence sharing, which would hamper Ukraine's ability to strike Russian targets either in occupied territory or inside Russia. These are not light levers. These hamper directly Ukraine's ability to defend itself against a Russian assault, which this current administration in America has made no announcements to hinder further. So I think, of course, it will be a relief if you hear these hints that this pause may well be temporary. But Ukraine has been stung in the past when it comes to international agreements, when it comes to failed ceasefires, where you have countries like Russia saying, yeah, we'll recognise Ukraine's territory. And ultimately, I mean, we all know what's happened since.
James Waterhouse in Kiev there. And as he mentioned, the head of the US Central Intelligence Agency has appeared to confirm the US has cut off intelligence sharing with Ukraine. We're going to try and come back to that story. Coming up, a new exhibition in London that showcases a critical medieval period in the development of Western art.
The painters working in Siena at this date were pushing the boundaries of what a painting could do, so thinking about painting as something that could tell a story or something that could express emotion or something that could even give a sense of space on a two-dimensional surface. So all ideas that we begin to associate later on with what a painting can do are being explored at this point in time.
More on that to come and our headlines this hour. President Trump has used a joint address to Congress to tout his border and immigration policies as a success. And there's been stark warnings in the EU about its car industry. The Commissioner for Industrial Strategy has warned car makers are facing a mortal danger. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Arab leaders have agreed on a post-war reconstruction plan for Gaza that would allow around 2 million Palestinians to remain in the territory during a rebuild. It's in sharp contrast to the plan proposed by United States President Donald Trump. He favours the development of a new beach resort, a Middle East Riviera, and suggests that Gazan population should be moved out to allow its construction. That idea has been rejected as a gross violation of international law, a crime against humanity and ethnic cleansing in the final communique agreed by the Arab League summit in Cairo yesterday. But will the Arab plan get wider international backing? It's going to cost around $53 billion and would see Gaza run temporarily by a Gaza management committee under the umbrella of the Palestinian government. Well, I've been speaking to Tamim Khalaf, who's spokesperson for the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, and he told us more about the plan.
Egypt has put together a comprehensive multi-phase and time-bound plan for the reconstruction of Gaza that will include three specific main phases that has been put forward actually by experts, urban planners, professionals. So the first phase really is an early recovery phase, and it extends for 6 months. It will include extensive programs for, first, the removal of approximately 50 million tons of rubble, and also the clearance of unexploded ordnances. And it will also offer urgent relief to Palestinians in Gaza by offering thousands of temporary housing that would temporarily shelter approximately 1.2 million Palestinians in Gaza. So that would be the early recovery phase. But there are two other phases that will center entirely on reconstruction. They will include the construction of a total of 400,000 permanent housing units, two ports, solar power plants, government service center, educational and medical facilities.
I mean, you mentioned the rubble there. The UN has said it's going to take around 15 years to clear this rubble. And we've had response to this plan from the US already. They're saying it doesn't address the reality that Gaza is currently uninhabitable. Is it possible to push through this plan if it doesn't have US support?
While we are aware of certain commentaries and maybe some suggestions and comments that they have, we look forward to engaging with the U.S. administration to make this come to fruition. And there will be an intention in the next coming weeks that we will have foreign ministers or Arab officials that will be visiting Washington, D.C., engaging with the U.S. administration. But I think we share the same objective. And I think it is important that Palestinians in Gaza remain in their homeland. Palestinians are exceptionally sensitive to attempts to detach them from their homeland and are well aware that departing Gaza may be a one-way ticket.
It would come under a Gaza management committee, which would be under an umbrella of the Palestinian government. And that plan has been welcomed by Hamas. They've issued a statement. But Hamas is still refusing to give up its weapons. And many will argue if they're still armed, they will still be the real power in Gaza.
Well, look, there is no perfect solution, but there are reasonable solutions. Yesterday, the Arab summit endorsed a new Palestinian committee, which will be established to administer and govern Gaza. This committee will be run by Palestinian technocrats that are not affiliated in any way or form with any factions. And their main functions will be to govern Gaza, to manage the humanitarian assistance, and serve for a transitional period, paving the way for the return of the Palestinian Authority to Gaza.
It is going to cost a lot of money, though, isn't it? In the budget put forward, it says around $53 billion. And I guess without a comprehensive peace plan, investors may be very reluctant to get involved just in case another conflict erupts.
Well, I think the nature of why the amount that is needed is so high is as a result of the extensive damage that the Israelis have done over the past 16 months. Palestinians in Gaza have endured an unspeakable humanitarian tragedy. But one of the things that have transpired or endorsed in yesterday's summit was the agreement to convene an international conference in Cairo, which will be done in coordination with Palestine and the United Nations, to advocate for a trust fund to channel financial commitments from donor countries and financing institutions. Palestinians need it, and therefore we were going to work extensively in order to try to achieve this objective.
Tamim Khalaf there from the Egyptian Foreign Ministry. Well, meanwhile, in Gaza, the World Health Organization says that at least 12,000 sick and wounded Palestinians still need immediate evacuation. UN officials estimate that around 30,000 people have life-changing injuries that will require years of rehabilitation. Among them is 9-year-old Rami, who did manage to get out. He arrived in Jordan last month at a Doctors Without Borders hospital, from where the BBC Caroline Hawley reports.
In the physiotherapy room here, there are patients pushing through their pain and discomfort, desperate to try to get something of their former lives back. It's a bright and cheery room, sunlight pouring through the windows, but everyone here has been through really dark times. The youngest of them here now is Rami. He's just 9, and his legs were really badly injured by shrapnel from an Israeli airstrike last summer in Gaza. It killed his older brother.
We were sleeping, and then they bombed our neighbour's house, and we were hit by shrapnel.
Rami is here with his physiotherapist, Zaid. He's put aside his red, blue and green crutches.
You want to play football?
With you?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
He supports Cristiano Ronaldo, so he wants to play football like him. This is the first time for me let him to play football by his leg.
So this is the first time he's kicked a football since his injury.
This is a big moment.
Yes.
Rami's with the nurse now, having the dressings on his legs changed. He's had one operation since he arrived at MSF's Specialised Hospital for Reconstructive Surgery, which treats victims of war from around the Middle East. It hurts, he says, but it's nothing like the agony he suffered during surgery in Gaza, with no painkillers and no antibiotics. His wounds were so infected they had maggots in them, and doctors said both legs would have to be amputated. Many more rounds of surgery lie ahead.
In Gaza, before the war, we used to have medical treatment, but then the aid stopped.
He lists his surviving brothers and father still in Gaza, and then breaks down, remembering 12-year-old Mustafa, who's no longer there.
I see him in my dreams, laughing and happy. I see him as an angel.
Mustafa's mum, Islam, accompanied Rami to Jordan, hard as it was to leave Gaza and the grave of her oldest child.
My heart is in Gaza. My soul is in Gaza. Despite what happened in Gaza, I love it.
Rami's dad in Gaza has his brother Aboud on his lap, tickling him to try to cheer him up. Aboud is 8 years old and one of many, many amputees. He lost his lower right leg and has crutches to walk on, but no prosthetic yet. When the Israeli military allowed Rami and his mum to leave Gaza in January, Aboud and his dad weren't able to go too.
Hi, Rami. Habibi.
They've been keeping in touch as much as they can by phone, and sometimes there's been just enough signal for a blurry video call. Rami tells his family he misses them and wants to show his dad how he can now get up by himself and stand on his own 2 feet. You're strong, his father tells him. You're a hero, a hero. And today, another reason for the family to cheer. The Israeli authorities have just allowed Rami's brother and their father to leave Gaza for Jordan so that Aboud can get treatment too.
The BBC's Caroline Hawley with that report. Welcome back to NewsHour. To Romania next, where last November a surprise candidate, Calin Georgescu, a radical anti-globalist with pro-Russian sympathies, won the first round of the presidential election. The Constitutional Court then cancelled the result, alleging Russian interference and campaign funding fraud. Well, that election has now been rescheduled for early May, but will Mr. Georgescu be allowed to take part? From Bucharest, Nick Thorpe sent this report from a rally of his supporters.
A sea of Romanian flags in central Bucharest. Last Saturday, tens of thousands of Romanians marched through their capital in support of Calin Georgescu, a 62-year-old agricultural engineer who says he wants to put Romania first.
I asked Dragos, a Romanian living in Canada, what he's protesting against.
They want to keep Romania under the globalists. They want the war. They want to kill the people. We are nothing for them. We are just meat. We can die. They gonna be richer and richer.
Many in the crowd blame the war in Ukraine not on Russia, but on what they see as a global elite. They accuse the current Romanian government of being a puppet of that elite, while their critics portray their hero, Calin Georgescu, as a puppet of the Russians.
We want freedom of choosing and the democracy. Freedom,
freedom! So you want Mr. Georgescu to win the election?
Yes, yes, and he will.
Lavinia is marching with her husband, Sherban, and their three-year-old daughter, watching it all wide-eyed from her pushchair, astonished by the commotion all around her.
I can see who you are for, but who or what are you against?
The government. All people in the government.
Back in December, Romania came under US pressure from the outgoing Biden administration, as well as its NATO allies in Europe, to prevent Calin Georgescu's victory. Now the Trump administration is pressuring Romania to let him run. Their response was dramatic. In a series of raids across the country, police discovered gold bullion, cash and an arsenal of weapons. They belonged to Horatiu Potra, a former soldier in the French Foreign Legion who backs Calin Georgescu in the May election.
They're quite serious allegations, conspiring against the constitutional order, membership of a neo-fascist organisation, anti-Semitism. You don't believe this?
No. It's not true.
Georgescu has been photographed with Potra, who also ran militias in Africa. And Potra made no secret of his support for Georgescu, though it's not clear what prosecutors will be able to prove in court. But the charges against him may be cited to disqualify him from standing in the May election.
And that was the BBC's Nick Thorpe there reporting from Bucharest on the latest in Romanian politics ahead of that election. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. More on that story of the CIA director, John Radcliffe, seeming to confirm that President Trump has ordered a pause in intelligence sharing with Ukraine. Mr. Radcliffe was speaking to Fox News and he said the decision came after Mr. Trump questioned President Volodymyr Zelensky's commitment to peace following that spat we've been speaking about at the White House last Friday. But Mr. Radcliffe did go on to highlight that Mr. Zelensky had attempted to repair relations with Mr. Trump afterwards, expressing hope that military and intelligence support to Kiev would or could be resumed. Let's get the latest on this now by crossing to Washington, D.C. and our correspondent Tom Bateman. What kind of reaction has there been to this latest newsline coming from the director of the CIA?
Well, what we've heard from both John Radcliffe, the head of the CIA, as you say, and Mike Waltz, who is the National Security Advisor at the White House, they've both been asked this question in the last hour about whether or not intelligence sharing with Ukraine is part of the President Trump-ordered suspension of military assistance to Ukraine that was announced on Monday. Both have confirmed that intelligence is involved, Mr. Radcliffe saying it's on the military and intelligence fronts, and Mike Waltz saying that the pause is on all aspects of the relationship. Now, in terms of the significance of that, this is absolutely crucial information that the US spy agency gives to its counterparts in Ukraine for both strategic reasons in terms of understanding Moscow's approaches to the war, its next strategic moves, but also tactical information, for example, programming coordinates into artillery rockets like the US-supplied HIMARS system, that those coordinates are then used by the Ukrainians to target Russian troops on the battlefield. So the suspension of that information will have an immediate effect on the war itself, on Ukraine's ability to defend itself. And also some suggestions in the American media coming from anonymous sources in the Ukrainian military, that actually the suspension on some intelligence data goes back even further than the last couple of days, and potentially for up to the last month, that they've been unable to fire over the lines into Russia itself because they haven't had those coordinates from the United States. Now, we don't have confirmation of that, but clearly there has been now being confirmed a suspension of a significant amount of intelligence data for the Ukrainians.
That's very interesting information, Tom. Thanks for that. I mean, there was a question mark over this issue of intelligence, wasn't there, after the suspension of the military funding. It was being asked in public, but nobody really seemed to know. And I'm just seeing now that here in the UK, the Prime Minister's official spokesperson has declined to comment on whether the US, whether the White House has instructed the UK to suspend the sharing of US intelligence with Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the frequent answer to any questions about intelligence from political leaders is that they won't comment. But clearly, we're now having confirmation, at least from the US side, about the direct bilateral intelligence sharing relationship between the US and Ukraine. Whether or not that would extend to the US's European partners is, of course, an entirely separate question. We know that the tone has been very much from the Europeans, that they absolutely stand in solidarity with the Ukrainians. And so you wouldn't expect there to have been a similar effect. But it will, for example, have an effect on their ability to use European-supplied weapons in terms of targeting, because the intelligence information from the US is second to none. I mean, they simply don't get the same amount or quality of information from their European partners.
All right, for the moment, thank you so much for joining us there with that breaking news from the US. That's the BBC's Tom Bateman in Washington, D.C. Now, we've been hearing about that big speech President Trump gave last night. Well, there's also been a very important speech made today by the Chinese Premier, Li Xiang. He was addressing the opening session of the National People's Congress. He set a growth target of 5% for the economy, but he also warned that an increasingly complex situation outside the country might impact trade. He said rapid changes were happening across the world not seen in a century. Yesterday, of course, we saw the US slap new tariffs on China, which were then reciprocated. Premier Li Qiang said China was navigating international challenges.
Internationally, changes unseen in a century are unfolding across the world at a faster pace. An increasingly complex and severe external environment may exert a greater impact on China in areas such as trade, science and technology. Global economic growth lacks steam. Unilateralism and protectionism are on the rise. The multilateral trading system is experiencing disruptions and tariff barriers continue to increase. All this is undermining the stability of global industrial and supply chains and impeding flows in the international economy.
Premier Li Qiang there. Well, Dr. Olivia Chung is a lecturer in politics at King's College London. She's also the author of the book, The Political Thought of Xi Jinping. So I asked her for Beijing's take on the new tariffs announced yesterday.
It was mentioned implicitly when Premier Li Qiang emphasized the steadiness and stability of the Chinese economy, and also importantly, China welcoming, you know, foreign investment. So all these were assigned to contrast the Chinese government's approach to foreign trade and economic management with Donald Trump.
He did mention, though, I think he said changes unseen in a century are unfolding across the world at a faster pace. Was that also sort of looking at what's been going on in the diplomatic sphere over the past few weeks?
So the notion transformations unseen in a century unfolding in an accelerated pace is Xi Jinping's own strategic assessment of international power balance. This is a polite way of saying the East, with China defining the East, is rising rapidly and the West, defined by America, is declining in a rapid speed. And Trump's trade war and his kind of diplomacy is seen by the Chinese government as highly self-destructive and harmful for America's position, the Western bloc's position in the international order. And what the Chinese government have been trying to do under Xi is really to bring up developing countries with China at the center to replace the Western bloc to be the dominant force in the international order.
I mean, what might that mean in terms of China's relationship with Europe? Would that open more flexibility on that? And if it did, how might that affect China's relationship with Russia?
Xi Jinping is trying very hard to wedge Europe from the United States. But having said that, very major fundamental shift that can lead to fundamental change in China's relationship with Europe is most unlikely because Xi Jinping would not give up on Putin. However, more economic carrots are likely to be on the table to tempt Europe to adopt an approach to China that is different from the Trump approach to China.
We've obviously been discussing a lot over the past few days about that unprecedented meeting in the Oval Office between Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Trump last week. And I know that the Chinese media had a lot to say about that and also reflected on the fact that China did put forward a peace plan for Ukraine about 2 years ago, didn't it? But I was just seeing in the Xinhua, the state news agency, earlier this week, describing what happened in the Oval Office as being colonialist and nothing more than a sophisticated repackaging of the logic of pirates. I think that was in relation to the mineral deal.
I think China is very thankful to Donald Trump and his approach for diplomacy. It fits really neatly with what Xi Jinping have been saying for a long time, that Western countries take care of their own interest and, you know, leave developing countries to the sideline. And this image of President Zelensky being bullied by President Trump can fit into that discourse quite nicely. But what doesn't really fit that narrative is that Europe hasn't left Zelensky behind. And the other thing to bear in mind is that China's peace proposal for Ukraine offered back a few years ago is not a genuine peace proposal in any sense. Very ambiguous. It's full of aspirational goals that everybody can agree. So it's not genuinely about trying to negotiate a ceasefire or to end the war. It's a very grandstanding gesture. So it's fundamentally different from the kind of peace proposals that we are talking about today.
Dr. Olivia Chung there. Now, this week sees the start of the new school year in South Korea, with millions of children across the country heading back to their classrooms. Teachers, however, are concerned about a growing trend of students making deep fake or non-consensual images of staff members and posting them on social media. The BBC's Korean services Hwo Tong Kim and Eugene Choi spoke to several educators who felt let down by the response of the authorities.
설득하고 증거를 모으고 사건을 입증해야 했죠.
Sitting on a sofa in a living room, Ji-hee talks about how she used to love teaching at a high school in Incheon, South Korea. That was until her world was torn apart.
저와 제 동료 교사 선생님의 사진이 트위터에
Photos of me and another teacher were uploaded on Twitter. I was so shocked. When I received the screenshots, there were four images of my face and body, including my buttocks, circulating on Twitter. Below the images, hashtags like teacher humiliation and acquaintance humiliation were attached.
Ji-hee, whose name and voice we have changed, is a victim of a growing trend in South Korean schools.
The account was not only posting hidden camera photos of teachers, but also deepfake generated images of victims. It was extremely sexually humiliating and degrading.
Please eradicate these digital sex crimes.
Telegram deepfake.
The reality of deepfake sex crimes on Telegram. It has become a direct threat to our society.
While shocking, her experience is far from unusual in South Korea. In August, a survey via Teachers Union found 2,492 cases where a member had been a victim of illegally manipulated images. Across the country, the number of police reports about deepfake sex crimes rose from 156 in 2021 to 1,202 in 2024. But despite the scale of the issue, Ji-hee felt let down by the response she received from authorities.
피해자가 처음부터 끝. The burden is entirely on the victim to prove everything. We have to persuade law enforcement, gather evidence, and prove our case. So I decided to investigate myself. I went to the school and tested different positions to see where someone could have taken those hidden camera shots.
Teaming up with another teacher, Ji-hee worked out that there was only one desk in the classroom where the pictures could have been taken. And because she knew which student sat there, now she knew who was responsible.
Since I was young, I always dreamed of becoming a teacher.
Yi Ga-eun, whose voice and name we have also changed, is another teacher who has been affected.
They explained that a manipulated image of my face edited onto the upper body of a topless woman was circulating in a Telegram chat room.
The middle school teacher from Busan found it impossible to keep on working. Teachers are often expected to continue doing their job after being victimized, even when the student responsible might still be in their classroom.
And that report from Hwo Tong Kim and Yujin Choi there from the BBC Korean service. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour Live from the BBC. Now, here in London, the National Gallery's new exhibition of religious paintings from early 14th century Siena has already been a sensation at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It's a co-curation between the two galleries, which brings together priceless works of Sienese art for the first time in about 700 years. The exhibition argues that Siena has been unjustly overshadowed by its Tuscan neighbour, Florence, in the history of art, and that it's actually in Siena where painting really emerged as the preeminent art form. The colours are astonishing. Gold shines out from every wall, as I've been hearing from Laura Llewellyn, who's one of the curators of the exhibition here in London.
In the exhibition, we are exploring the art of painting in Siena between about 1300 and 1350. And we're doing this by a kind of deep dive into the careers of four painters, Duccio di Buoninsegna, the brothers Ambrogio and Pietro Lorenzetti, and Simone Martini. And these are artists who are working on all different scales and all different types of objects. So, you know, working in monumental fresco or great towering altarpieces, all the way down to small, very intimate works for private devotion. And we're really looking at these painters as artists who are on the kind of cusp, moving away from what we might think of as perhaps the Byzantine influence, where the power and the importance of the icon is being moved away from, and artists are beginning to imbue their pictures with something closer to a kind of human sentiment and really exploring a kind of human experience through paint.
Right. So you're talking about the former religious icons, which had been, you know, what so much art had been in the period before. So in terms of the development of Italian art, why was Siena so important?
Siena at this date and in the century before is a real hotspot. It holds a pivotal position on the Via Francigena, which is the major thoroughfare, the pilgrimage route which connects Canterbury to Rome. And it's not just bringing pilgrims in and out of the city, but also tradespeople and, crucially, objects. So it's this amazing kind of furnace, in a way, for visual encounters. Siena is also really plugged into the Silk Road because of the access it has to the ports in southern Tuscany. So you have these extraordinary connections east to west as well.
And in terms of what the pictures look like, the style coming from Siena at this time, how would you describe it?
Many of the pictures have a kind of dominant presence of gold. One of the things that I think is so mesmerizing about the gold in this exhibition is the way in which artists are so adept at manipulating it. They are real masters in the art of tooling and punching and scraping and scratching in order to create the most dazzling surface effects on the gold, whether it's, you know, the decorative appearance of textiles or the amazing intricacy of a halo or even punched areas of, you know, inscriptions. And so the gold for me is a way in. It's a mesmerizing aspect of these paintings. And during the period that we're exploring, we really see painters kind of rising to the status of goldsmiths and even beyond. And a lot of that is to do with this real technical proficiency in the working of gold.
So this collection, you've brought together works that have never been seen together, well, certainly not for hundreds of years. And you're really trying to shine a light on this period of art, which, I mean, many people are saying has been overshadowed, rather, by Siena's neighbour and rival, Florence.
Yes, one of the things that we're most proud of and most excited about in the exhibition is the reunifications. It's been a major kind of feat of the project, and it's thanks in large part to the trust of the lenders who've shared these exquisite works with us and enabled us to bring ensembles back together that have been separated sometimes for many centuries. And, you know, we're not trying to suggest that nothing was happening in Florence and it was all happening in Siena. Of course we're not. You know, even as we speak, there's an exhibition going on at the Louvre exploring Cimabue, for example. But what we're trying to do really is complicate the story and make a case for how incredibly important Siena was to the development of a Western tradition of painting that is really in a kind of state of germination at this point. And that's really because the painters working in Siena at this date were pushing the boundaries of what a painting could do, so thinking about painting as something that could tell a story or something that could express emotion or something that could even give a sense of space on a two-dimensional surface. So all ideas that we begin to associate later on with what a painting can do are being formulated and explored at this point in time.
And what is the great advantage of seeing all these works together in a collection, not just sort of seeing them one at a time or individual moments?
I think works of art from this period especially, which have migrated over the course of their lives into collections and onto gallery walls, have often been divorced from their original context. So particularly early paintings from the 14th century were very rarely intended to be pinned onto a wall. They were often either to stand on an altar or on a smaller scale, perhaps to be held in the hand. And so in a way, we are kind of reinstating the nature of these works as objects. And by bringing them back together, we're able to get much closer to the artist's creative powers, essentially, in formulating these objects and not thinking about them as individual scenes that we pop in a frame and put on the wall, but instead thinking about them as sequences and works which really speak from one to the next. And, you know, one will propel the other forward, as it were.
Mm. That said, though, if there were one that you would pick out, which would it be?
It's a tricky one. It's like choosing between your children. But I would say that one of the absolute stars of the show and that we are obviously delighted to have in the exhibition is the painting that we end the exhibition on, which is the Holy Family that comes from the Walker Collection in Liverpool. It's an absolutely remarkable moment of drama, but also a kind of family spat, which I think really encapsulates what Sienese painters are achieving at this date, which is kind of bringing the heavenly figures, the biblical figures, into the realm of the human and showing viewers that they were just like us.
And for those that aren't in London, can't see this exhibition easily, is there anything online that the art gallery is putting forward for people who might be interested?
Absolutely. There will be a video coming shortly and various, you know, opportunities to engage with the exhibition through digital means and through social media. We also have a catalogue that was published by the National Gallery, and there was a shared endeavour between the Metropolitan Museum of Art, our partner in this project, and we hope a real legacy for the study of this period.
And that was Laura Llewellyn there, one of the curators of that exhibition in London at the moment at the National Gallery. And as she mentioned there, art lovers around the world can access images from that collection on show at the moment online. So just do a search for National Gallery London, I guess. That's it for this edition. Thanks so much for joining us from me and the team. Bye-bye for now.